I mean, unfortunately, our economic system is just a byproduct of a capitalist society. The greed of people with money that want more money from those who don't have the emotional willpower to think otherwise. The government has to be responsible for what goes where, what's used, what's consumed.
Yeah, it's really difficult because it makes me feel really a lot of despair about us in the future and about the way that I plan my life around having a family. Like, do I even want to do that? Do I want to put someone into this world? Like, there's a lot of stress around the future for me, but then at the same time, it kind of leads me to feeling numb about it because there's so much stress about it.
So I feel angry about how our greed and capitalism is ruining the world for us and for our future generations. It makes me feel crazy. Whatever we do as individuals or even as communities might be helpful at the local level, but not kind of saving the whole planet. We are heading towards a disaster. Maybe it might not happen in my lifetime, but we're getting there, and we are doomed as a species.
Many people feel overwhelmed by the fact that the levels of consumerism and overconsumption, particularly in the global north, are eating up the earth resources at an increasingly unsustainable rate. This is System Shift, and today we explore what we can do to reverse ecological overshoot, a concern that resonates with the very heartbeat of our planet. Earth Overshoot Day falls earlier each year as humanity's ecological footprint surpasses the Earth's capacity to regenerate resources and absorb waste. Last year it fell on August 2nd, and I can guarantee it will fall an even earlier date this year. It's a critical measure of how our collective actions impact the delicate balance of the biosphere, and it's a concept that demands our attention. Today, we are joined by Peter Victor, a leading expert in ecological sustainability and economics. Peter is Professor Emeritus and Senior Scholar at York University in Canada. He was founding president of the Canadian Society of Ecological Economics and is a past president of the Royal Canadian Institute for Science. In the 1990s, he even served as Assistant Deputy Minister for the Environmental Science and Standards Division in the Ontario Ministry for the Environment. Today, Peter maintains an active research program as a co-investigator in the Center for Understanding Sustainable Prosperity and through the Ecological Footprint Initiative at York University. In this episode, we embark on a journey through the intricacies of economic growth, ecological overshoot, and the pursuit of a well-being economy. Peter dissects the historical roots of our environmental challenges, questions the conventional pursuit of endless economic growth, and explores the alternative models. Discover how balancing progress with environmental sustainability is not just a possibility, but a necessity. So, without further ado, a warm welcome to you, Peter.
Thank you, Carl. I'm very pleased to be here.
Yeah, it's so nice. I actually read some of your books many years ago already, and now you're here. So let's kick this off. But I mean, yes, you have been doing so many things over the years. What's the last week? What have you been up to then?
Well, the last week was a very special week, as it turns out. I was the host of a visit from Iceland, a professor there with whom I'm co-directing a major project on the ecological footprint. And so we had a wonderful week of meetings and social events. And so I just wish life was like that all the time. But that was a very special week.
And ecological footprint, what does that mean?
So the ecological footprint is a measure of the impact that humanity makes on the biosphere. And you can think of it in global terms, all the way down to the individual, which makes it a very useful way of measuring our impact on the biosphere, because sometimes we want to discuss what individuals can do to reduce their footprint, what nations can do, what continents can do, and what the global population can do. So this is a measure that's been around for about 30 years. And now at my university, we estimate the ecological footprint for every country in the world. And we do that every year. And it's all out on the internet. Everybody listening in can check the ecological footprint of their country and the world. And we also measure the biocapacity, the capacity of the planet or any area of land to support the ecological footprint.
And that is not constant, and this is a worrying trend we have seen lately.
No, it's not constant. The biocapacity part is actually quite difficult because humans can increase biocapacity as well as reduce it. But the general trend is a reduction in biocapacity at the same time as we are increasing the burden we're placing on the planet to support us. And that's why we, some of us, myself included, say we've entered an era of overshoot, because we're putting more pressure on the biosphere, more demand on the biosphere to support us than it's capable of providing.
And the title of your book, latest book at least, is Escape from Overshoot. And that's actually the subject of today, more or less. But before we go there, we should have a look at how we ended up where we are. What are the mechanisms behind this constantly growing overshoot?
Well, it's a simple question to ask and a difficult question to answer. In my own mind, I go back to the birth of capitalism, which changed dramatically the way the system works. And since the theme of this discussion is system change, it's worth noting that. If we think of pre-capitalism in Europe, to the feudal society, people were serfs working for their lords and were not free. Wage labor emerged out of feudalism because merchants started getting established in cities and they needed a different arrangement. They weren't lords, they had to hire people, and gradually the merchants accumulated wealth, which they were able to invest in factories, and you had the birth of capitalism through that transition from feudalism to something very different. The question then that you asked really comes down to, is it in the nature of capitalism to continue to expand, to continue to increase the requirement for materials and for energy, to transform land from wild to human-controlled, and so on? And many people answer that question in the affirmative. Yes, it's built into this economic system we have. And when it faltered, as it did so seriously in the 1930s, I'm coming to more recent times, you realize here.
A quick leap there, yeah.
What was then a well-established capitalism system in countries like the UK, much of Europe, and the US, and so on, fell into a sustained period of deep, deep unemployment. Economists have a very good explanation of this, because they believed, well, if there's lots of unemployment, wages would go down, employers would hire more people, and the system would somehow recreate full employment. And that's when this incredible economist, John Maynard Keynes, came along and said, it's the wrong way to think about it. The problem is that there's just not enough money being spent in the economy to demand the goods or pay for the goods that are required, and therefore to employ the people to make them. And so he suggested that the government should do what it takes to boost aggregate expenditure and resolve the unemployment problem. Now, here's the interesting thing, and it comes really centrally to the discussion today, is that he was only thinking of that as a short-term problem. Let's boost expenditure, reduce unemployment. But after the Second World War, it became great concern to a number of economists that if the government boosts the economy, and that includes building more factories, more roads, more harbors, all of those things, then that's going to require even more expenditure to keep all of that employed in the future. We get into this situation where you have to keep spending to keep people employed, and part of that expenditure expands the capacity of the economy, and so expenditure has to rise again. And by expenditure, it's just another way of saying what gross domestic product is. Gross domestic product can be measured as the total expenditure of goods and services in the economy. So this seems to be the situation we're in now. We've become very dependent on economic growth to keep unemployment reasonably low. We've also redefined the meaning of progress. It's just the final thing I'll say in answer to your question. Progress, when it was first talked about in the way that we might understand back in the mid part of the last millennium, because there was some evidence that things were changing, maybe changing for the better, and we had science and technology coming in and so on, some experience of improvement in living standards. But it went from a very broad concept, including social and ethical dimensions, as well as what we would consider purely economic. But now we think of progress almost exclusively in terms of economic growth. Let's expand the economy, and then whatever problem we've got, we can solve it because we'll be rich and we can buy our way out of it. The downside of that, of course, coming back to your question to me on overshoot, is that that very process has led to this increasing burden being placed on the planet. And now we have a real dilemma. How do we escape from overshoot, but still find a way of maintaining good living styles for lots of people, everybody ideally? And that's what my book is really about. How do we escape from overshoot and maintain well-being, not just for humans, but for all other species as well?
I think that's a really important thing, because when you talk about GDP, a lot of things are left out. If this growth is based on increased hatred or love, makes no difference. If it's based on things that destroy nature or regenerate, well, in the short term, at least, you can't see any difference. And then when you degrade the systems, you will see an economic effect too. But there are so many things in the measurement itself, and unpaid work, for example, or charity work is not there at all, or housework.
And there are also things included that we can be pretty confident are not really indicating that we're getting better off. So, for example, if crime rates are going up and so we spend more money on police and on extra protection, that sort of thing, well, that all goes into GDP. But it's not a sign of improved well-being. It's a sign of the opposite. Now, it's worth noting that the person who did the most to really develop GDP as an idea and as a measurement was an American economist called Simon Kuznets, who in the mid-1930s did the original work on the measurement of GDP. And he made the point that do not judge the well-being of the United States through this measure. He said it explicitly, it's not a measure of welfare. It's a question of if you want growth, growth in what? Some things are good, some things are bad. He was there right at the start. And unfortunately, his message has largely been forgotten.
Not only forgotten, rejected completely. I mean, 85 years later, most political parties in the world see that as the measurement to measure if they're successful or not.
Yes, I'm afraid that's true. But I do see some slight changes happening. For example, I saw a new website out of the province of Quebec here in Canada, where they're working on a set of well-being indicators. It's not just one. It's closer to about 70, I think, because they want to make the shift that many of us have talked about but not been able to achieve, away from directing their policies towards increased growth to increased well-being. And measuring different things will help that.
Already 2009, when I was a member of the European Parliament, the Commissioner for Environment, Mr. Potocnik, then introduced Beyond GDP concept, where he wanted to have 15 other indicators that we should measure progress against and still keep GDP, but at least, you know, level it out with other measurements. So this talk about measuring other things has been there for a long time, but the policies hasn't really followed.
I think the way I see it, and I had two periods in my professional career working in the government of Ontario as an economist, a senior civil servant later on. And when I was a senior civil servant in the Ontario government, one of the things that I had to come to terms with, that anything that the Ministry of Environment proposed was tested against what it would mean for economic growth. Sometimes that was for employment or for productivity, but it was all can all be wrapped up in this desire to make the economy grow faster. Whereas anything that came out of what the one or other of the economic ministries didn't have to be tested against its environmental implications. So there was this built-in imbalance in the way that policy was developed and evolved. But I also do believe that the work that is going on, has been going on, as you mentioned, for a long time, actually well before 2009, on better ways of measuring what really matters is important, because unless we can do that, the pro-GDP growth argument always wins out, because it sounds so simple. We've got to have more growth. I would submit that most people who promote the growth of GDP don't really know what it's made of. They still say it's very important that we have it.
But then also I think it's interesting if you go even one step further there, you measure what's on your mind. So it's this mindset I think is interesting. In your book, you talk about the view of nature as a production machine, as a nature capital and so on. I think how we view nature is also a key here in changing what we focus on.
Yes, I agree with that. Well, the first thing to realize is that economists, by and large, when they conceive of the economy, they conceive of it as independent of nature. You can look at the simple diagrams that are presented to students of economics, which show how governments and businesses and households interact, employing one another, spending money, that sort of thing. But nature is invisible. It's not there. But none of this economic activity can happen without obtaining materials and energy from nature. And at the same time, because of fundamental physical laws, whatever we take from nature doesn't disappear. The laws of conservation don't let that happen. So we can trace now where that material and energy goes, and eventually it virtually all goes back into nature. And the more we extract, and ultimately leads to more disposal, that's the problem we've got ourselves in. And if we think of the economy and we pay no attention to what we call throughput, the throughput of materials and energy, and I would add to that the transformation of land, we're bound to make terrible mistakes in terms of policy, because we're going to discovering we've caused effects that we never anticipated because they were outside our framework.
How would you define throughput?
Throughput is really a contraction of input and output. So if you think of the input of a trees going into a pulp mill, the output will be the pulp that comes out of the mill, plus all of its waste products. So we use the word throughput to remind ourselves that all physical inputs do become outputs of various kinds, some we want and some we don't want. So the term throughput is both a combination of input and output.
And both wanted and unwanted products.
In the sense that the output includes, yes, wanted and unwanted. And here's the thing, European countries all track their material throughput. We're behind over here in Canada, but I've been on the Eurostat database and I've looked at all of that data for European countries. Very impressive.
Well, at least we did one thing right. But if you look at the data and how we increase this throughput of waste and other things, it's not so uplifting though. And also, I mean, logically, because the throughput when we had proto-capitalism a few hundred years ago, these merchants that escaped serfdom and tried to make some profits in dealing and wheeling with each other, still then the limiting capacity was our capacity to transform nature into something that made life more comfortable. But today, we have this concept of full world economics compared to empty world economics that they lived in. And I think it was Herman Daly who introduced that term. But could you explain a little bit the logic, a bit the difference between a full world economics and an empty world economics, please?
Yes, well, you're quite right to attribute that to Herman Daly. By an empty world, which is a strange term in a way, but he was using it to emphasize that for most of human history, humans were a small player on the planet writ large. They had local effects and regional effects. In terms of global impacts, the humans were not really responsible for anything at that level until quite recently. So he talked about that as an empty world, but he was thinking of the physical flows of material and energy from nature through the economy back to nature again, and then recognizing that things have changed, the scale on which our economies function requires so much more material and energy and produces so much more waste and transforms so much more land, that he's saying we now have to recognize that we live in a full world, a world in which we're 8 billion people. I mean, there's one estimate that plays on my mind a lot, and that is that if you weigh all the mammals living on planet Earth, only 4% or so are wild. The other 6% are either humans, we're about a third of the total, plus the animals that owe their existence to us because we breed them and eat them.
Yeah, of land living mammals, and that is. That is an interesting graph I recommend people to look up. It's quite shocking when you see it.
So just to say a little bit more about that, what Daly taught us, because he really pushed us very hard in his life, was that our policies need to change to recognize that we're now in a full world, maybe an overly full world. And that's the one of the big policy challenges, because it's hard to think of policies which will reduce the material and energy throughput that don't lower the rate of economic growth. And there are exceptions. There are some that, well, you could say do both, but by and large, it's not likely to be very good for economic growth.
Well, let's tackle this green growth theme that is so popular.
Yes, it is popular. It's one of many terms that people may have heard. We hear about inclusive growth, pro-poor growth, equitable growth, sustainable growth. All of these are adjectives put in front of the word growth, which remind us that not all is well with growth, because if it was, we wouldn't need to say, well, there's a certain kind of growth that we can still pursue. Green growth is perhaps the most popular, certainly within environmental discussions. And basically, it says that we can have economic growth, increased quantity and value of goods and services that we buy, at the same time as reducing the impact that our economy makes on the environment. And we most often hear about this in relation to climate change. So what it translates into is that we can increase GDP at the same time as we reduce greenhouse gas emissions. But even that's problematic because of something we call the rebound effect, where if you make something more efficient, in a capitalist economy, that can also make it cheaper. So the output of that more efficient process is a cheaper product. Well, what do people do when they're confronted with cheaper products? They typically buy more. And so the total output of this more efficient production process can actually be an increase in material and energy requirements in total.
Yeah, I think there you can like ask people to think about when they visited their grandmother's home when they were children, as many years ago as you can remember. You will see the difference in how that house, and probably your house you're living in today, is lighted, for example. That now when we have very efficient LED lightings, you will see that we have much more lamps and they are used more hours per day. So in many economies, the share of the household used for electricity, used for lighting, is actually not going down, despite the fact that lamps use a fifth or even less of energy compared to before. That's an example of the rebound effect.
That's a very good example. So green growth in relation to climate change can be understood as follows, that the GDP keeps rising, greenhouse gas emissions keep declining. One of the useful measurements to understand what's entailed is greenhouse gases per dollar of GDP. Because there's lots of evidence to show that you can have a reduction in greenhouse gases emitted per dollar. But the question is, can you do it fast enough to compensate for the pull in the other direction, which is more and more dollars, more and more GDP? And a lot of governments have committed themselves and businesses to net zero, which means at some point in time, 2040, 2050, sometimes a little earlier, a little later, they're saying we'll have zero greenhouse gas emissions when you take account of the reduced greenhouse gas emissions per dollar and the amount of any residual greenhouse gases that we can sequester underground or counteract by planting more trees. Now, the problem with that approach is that climate change is not the annual emission of greenhouse gases. It's the accumulation of greenhouse gases that causes the problem. And so just to say you're going to get to net zero 30 years in the future isn't good enough, because so much depends upon the path that you take together. In other words, the emissions per dollar and economic growth over that intervening period. So you could have greenhouse gas emissions, just take a ridiculous case, no change at all for, say, 29 years. And in the last year, you get down to zero through some magical technology. Well, the amount of greenhouse gases that would have been added to the atmosphere in that period, if there's no reduction on an annual basis between now and then, it would be enormous. So what we can do is we can calculate how fast would we have to reduce greenhouse gas emissions per dollar if the economy is growing at 2% a year, just to take a reasonable amount, and you find it would have to be like 10% a year. In other words, the greenhouse gas emissions per dollar economy-wide, whether that's Germany, Canada, the US, would have to be about 10% a year. Well, I took a look at the data in the world that the World Bank publishes, and not a single OECD country except Romania has ever reduced its greenhouse gas emissions per dollar by 10% for more than 3 years, going back the last 30 years. And now we're saying we're going to do it over the next 30 years, roughly, every year in a row. Well, it's just not happening. So the green growth promise, I think, is a bad distraction.
And I would like to add two more dimensions there. Because when we talk about this, we normally talk about national emissions. If you look at consumption-based emissions from many rich countries, they are obviously higher. We import a lot of things produced in low-cost countries. And a third aspect here is, for example, my home country, Sweden. We have reduced our emissions with 37%, our national emissions, since 1990. But actually, we haven't reduced them at all if you calculate the increase of biogen emissions. So our combustion economy is exactly the same as 1990. So here you also have a false mathematics, too.
Yes. Well, that's a very sad piece of information you've provided. I wasn't aware of that because many of us look to Sweden as a good example of how to run an economy and have a good life and pay attention to social justice.
Sorry for ruining that, but you should come and visit our forests and you see what we have done with them. So, but that's exactly what you mentioned, actually. Earlier now today, you talked about something called reducing the throughput. And this is exactly what I'm talking about here. We replaced fossil throughput with biogen throughput that had other consequences for nature, biodiversity, land use, and so on. And this is where we need to have this also challenging of the concept of green growth, I think.
You know, once we understand the appeal of green growth, which is we can have economic growth and take care of the environment, so let's get on with the next problem because we know how to deal with that one. When we realize that's not a viable future, we have to then think about, well, what are the alternatives? And just going back to the idea of the full world, I don't think there's any alternative that doesn't entail a deliberate reduction in throughput. And that implies limits. Countries, nation states, because we're still a world of nation states, are introducing regulations which require an absolute reduction in materials extracted from the ground and other places in accordance with some planned reduction that will bring us back into balance with the biosphere. But you can imagine, and I'm sure people listening in realize that those kinds of measures are very hard to implement politically because Canada, we have the big mining sector, it employs a lot of people. The governments are always trying to find ways to expand and encourage mining. So to turn that around, just that little slice of the pie is enormously problematic.
And then different countries have different challenges also, because like in the global north, our demands to reduce emissions is much higher than the global south, that both literally and historically have a different baseline, so to speak.
Yeah.
So in your book, you talk about this, that the demands on the global north should be different than the global south also. You talk about convergence in emissions reduction. Yeah.
Generally speaking, the richer you are, the more you're able to protect yourself against the bad effects of whether it's climate change or soil deficiencies, so the food prices go up, or water shortages, and so on, things that we're seeing. So the inequality that exists is a further consideration. So not only do we need to reduce throughput, which is likely to prevent us getting the kind of economic growth we used to, may well require reduction in economic output. Now, you're quite right. I was drawn towards this concept of contraction and convergence as a sort of an ethical principle for defining a way forward. And what it means is that those of us, whether that's nationally or individually, whatever groups you want to talk about, that are well above any kind of sustainable level of throughput that's serving them, that has to contract. And those below a long-term sustainable level can expand within limits. We have to make some, well, what they call ecological space for poorer people. And so we eventually, way into the future, I have to say, can converge upon some level of material and energy well-being. Culturally, there can be enormous differences, but the extent to which we draw on the planet for resources should be more or less equal among all of us.
And that's why in the global environment movement today, this just transition is so key for success, because that's the only way to get the global solidarity in this process. And we have many alternatives. Let's talk about alternatives. We talk about steady state economics. We talk about circular economy, well-being economy, WNVV, donut economy. There are so many propositions here. So do you want to mention a little bit like the pros and cons of different theories and what they leave out and so on? Shall we start with the circular economy?
Yes, well, I don't like to criticize any of them because they're all trying to move in what I consider the right direction. And none of them have the complete story. Mm. That's why in the book, I describe about seven or eight different ones, and you've mentioned some. But that said, the circular economy is a bit of a curiosity to me, because you can't have a circular economy. You can't take materials from nature, use them and reuse forever. They degrade. And this is particularly true with energy. And energy can't actually be recycled. Every time we use energy to do work, its capacity to do work declines. This is the so-called second law of thermodynamics. So we always have to keep finding new inputs of energy. Now, we've got the sun up there. That's going to be there for a long time, delivering energy to the Earth. So we're not just having to require on things we dig out of the ground. And that's why we're working hard, in some cases, to transition to a much greater dependence on solar and wind. But none of these things are without problems. For example, with solar, the energy is free, but the materials need to make use of it are scarce and have to be obtained from the ground. The steel, the aluminum, and the rare metals and so on, I think it is fairly clear. We're not going to be as likely to get as much useful energy from renewable sources as we've been able to get from fossil fuels for the last couple of hundred years. And that's just another reason why I, for one, don't think we can sustain the kind of material throughput that we've become accustomed to, because materials only become throughput when energy is used to make that happen. Whilst we cannot have a 100% circular economy, we certainly can move in the direction of circularity. So I understand its appeal to people, because it's not difficult to say, okay, well, how will we use materials more efficiently? Recycling, we can do better design of products. We can also make goods more durable. We can share more things. These are all circular economy initiatives that are promoted and now being implemented in many parts of the world. I'm all in favor of that.
I think it's important what you said here, that many people had the misconception that circular economy is about recycling and reusing. No, it goes beyond that. It's changing business models, sharing, and so on. So that's other parts of it. But when you talk about material degrading, for example, paper, pulp fibers, you can just recycle them up to maximum seven times. Then they are too short to be reused. And some products are inherently impossible to align with the circular economy. For example, a car tire, it will be worn out when used normally. So we have an economic system, and whatever economic system we have, we will never be able to have it totally circular. So yet again, we come back to what you mentioned before, throughputs. And if we compare throughput to a steady state economy, what would happen then?
So the idea of a steady state economy is to keep something steady. and Herman Daly, again, has written the most about this, offered us two sets of things we could hold steady. One is we could hold steady the built capital of our economy. So that means the infrastructure, the buildings, machines, and the population at some level that could be maintained at the lowest possible throughput that's consistent with what the environment can support. So in that version of a state economy, you're holding capital stocks, if I can use that term capital for population just for the moment, you're holding those constant whilst you minimize throughput. Later on, he offered, I think, a better definition, and that is that we should hold the throughput constant at levels consistent with what nature can accommodate over a long period of time, and allow the population of people and the capital stocks, the things we make, vary, provided we hold the throughput constant. And the reason I think that's better is because the majority of environmental impacts of what we do come from throughput rather than a building that's standing there, sitting there on the ground. It's the gasoline that's burnt in the cars that go on the highway that are doing us the biggest problem. I'm not saying the highway, when it was constructed, didn't involve environmental impacts, but it doesn't compare, in my mind, with the throughput of the gasoline and so on.
Or, for example, the energy use of the building while standing there for 100 years.
That's a very good example, too. So when I think of a steady-state economy, it's trying to come to a view on what level of throughput of material and energy can be supported over the long term, and how then can we as humans live the best lives possible within that constraint.
So the ideology behind that is, okay, we identify nature's carrying capacity, and then we make that as a system limits for the economic throughput.
Broadly speaking, but as we said, I think right at the start of this discussion, nature's carrying capacity isn't constant. Humans can vary it.
Yes, absolutely.
Irrigation, for example, makes land more productive and so on.
And then we have something that we have already had an episode this season about, a well-being economy and how that is defined. How do you see a well-being economy being defined?
Well, a well-being economy is an economy that is intended to generate well-being. It's almost tautological, but that's given away in the name. But it says that when we're deciding what to do, what policies government should pursue, what industries should be encouraged, what should be discouraged, the criteria should not be economic growth. It should be what constitutes to well-being. And there's been a lot of research on what contributes to well-being and what doesn't. And even without research, just from people's own life experiences, you can develop a view on what really adds to your well-being and what doesn't. So a well-being economy is one that is generates well-being, and by the way, does it in a socially just fashion as well. Now, just to expand on that a little bit and sort of sound a little note of hope here, one of the things that researchers have discovered is that many of the activities that humans do which add the most to their sense of well-being are activities which, generally speaking, don't impose such a burden on the biosphere. So going for a walk, for example, is almost, not entirely, but it's almost zero impact on the environment. And yet people do it. They do it over shorter and longer distances, and they do it for pleasure. Well, that's one of probably 100 activities which fall into that category, which give you this, what they now call sense of flow. When you get totally absorbed in an activity, the time passes and you've just had a great time. And people can get that from playing cards, in my case, I like doing jigsaw puzzles. Even some economics can give me that feeling. But everybody can get the sense of well-being from different things. And I'm very upbeat about this, and I'll tell you why. Because I think well-being is something that does have political appeal. And that's why we've seen a number of governments declare themselves as well-being governments. Now, they haven't gone far enough yet, but they're looking for ways to promote well-being first and foremost, and then think about what that means for the kind of economy they have. This is a great step forward. But, you know, just to go back to an earlier point, there's nothing in the circular economy that contradicts anything I've just said about the well-being economy.
No, exactly. I think this is where you can pick elements from all these solutions in order to help us avoid overshoot. And that's what your book is about. I mean, you mentioned jigsaw puzzles. I actually like that too. But I like even more to go out and pick berries and cook jam. But, you know, that's like that's being heretic towards the growth economy, because if I go out to pick my own berries, and even worse, if I use my old glass jar from last year, and even worse, if I use some fallen down branches from my garden and put a wood stove and fire it, there will be absolutely zero economic growth from that. Zero economic adding to the economy, but I'll still have my jar of jam and a nice time. So here you can see that the current model doesn't measure neither the well-being nor the value of what's produced.
No, you're quite right. But you see, this is why I think measurement has a really important place in helping us bring about system change. Because if we can make progress on measuring well-being, and that, as I said, suggests there's quite a lot of work going on in that regard, then politicians can point to how they have been able to improve well-being, which will appeal to those who benefit from that, and the emphasis on growth becomes reduced. Okay, governments have to know how much money is being spent in the economy, given the kind of economy we have. You need that to know for things like taxation and so on. But you don't need it as your primary objective that you want to make that number grow all the time.
But another thing that you have been evaluating is also the impact on working time, which is quite... We have one episode on that with Juliet Shaw, where we talk about the four-day work week and the 1,500 different organizations that she has been helping implement that and the very positive results we have seen from that. But you have also studied how technological progress and well-being progress can be assisted by reduced working time. I would like to hear your thoughts from an economist point of view on this.
Yes, okay. Well, when I first started working in this general area, I wanted to see whether a modern economy could manage without growth. That was the title of the book, Managing Without Growth. And I didn't know the answer to that when I began the research. And as I was working on the answer, one of the reasons I was saying before that governments pursue growth is to keep unemployment low. So the concern, and it's a reasonable one, is that, well, if we don't have growth, aren't we going to then have mass unemployment, especially with computers, AI, making it possible not to employ many people, so on. So it just became a question of arithmetic, which was that, well, if we were to keep gross domestic product constant, so no growth, and we shortened the average time people spent at work, then you could still have just as many people employed, but everybody would be working less. And you know, that's been the long-term trend in capitalism, at least it was until about 20-25 years ago in many countries. There was as labor became more productive, wages went up, you had economic growth, some bumps along the way, no doubt, but the work year got shorter and shorter. And that trend more or less stopped about a quarter of a century ago. So the lesson to learn from that is we can do two things with increased productivity. We can produce more stuff, or we can produce roughly the same amount of stuff, but work less. And one of the things that came out during COVID and is now still very much part of the public discussion here in Canada is this work-life balance issue. It was not really discussed before. Work was work, and that's what it was. But now we realize that maybe for many people, we haven't got the best balance, and that they would be better off with less work and more leisure time, especially the kind of leisure that doesn't have much impact on nature. And then we're beginning to see what living in a full world might look like, as in sort of slightly more concrete terms than perhaps we've been discussing to this point.
In the end of your book, Escape from Overshoot, you also have like 14 proposals or suggestions. And one of them brings back the issue of the importance of participation and democracy and being an active citizen. And here, this was the original logic when the Social Democratic Parties 100 years ago advocated 8-hour workday and so on. That was actually to give people time and energy and power to organize themselves and educate themselves in order to influence their and society's life. And you're bringing back this point. I think this is also strongly linked to reduced working time.
What you're referring to is these 14 propositions that I came up with, trying to think my way through to, well, what will it take to escape from overshoot? This is a step back from specific policies, which I also say something about, to what is it we really have to agree on if we're really going to wrestle with this problem of escape from overshoot? And so one aspect of that is, well, what kind of political system is likely to give us the best chance? And we've become, I think, overly accepting of representative democracy, where we just vote once every 4 or 5 years, send somebody to a building a long way from where we live, let them talk about things and give us policies and such. And the opportunity to participate in that process is really very, very limited. But it has its place. We need representative government, but participatory democracy, the idea that we find ways in which people can participate at many different levels, neighborhood all the way up to the national and even international, is really important. And some countries do a better job than that than others. So what I'm saying in that particular instance is that we need both representative and participatory democracy. And I tie this to another key proposition, which is that we need a common sense of purpose, which we don't have. It's hard to get overshoot on the political agenda because people's minds quickly think that's been no growth, that's terrible, we can't face up to that, let's go on to something else and drift into green growth arguments and things. But if to get a common sense of purpose, I think direct involvement of more people in the political process will be key.
But then, as you mentioned, the first point of your 14 proposals is exactly this: accept and agree on that we should avoid overshoot. And what would be needed to do that? I mean, how radical of a transformation would that be?
Well, I don't think there can be much doubt that we are in overshoot. I've mentioned the ecological footprint, which we have data going back to 1961 for every year, and you can just see overshoot emerging around 1970. It's not a new phenomenon. We've started to exceed the biocapacity of the planet globally in around 1970. But more recently, a group of scientists came up with this idea of planetary boundaries. They identified about 9 major environmental issues, climate change being one, fresh water, land transformation, what they call novel entities, a whole slew of these. It's all on the internet for anybody to look at. And they said, look, we've got some real threats here, because with some of these, you get a tipping point, climate change being the primary example. We're not just going to gradually, slowly get warmer and warmer. We can destabilize the climate system, so there's no way back, and we've got problems that we are unable to cope with. And then they said, but we don't really know exactly where these tipping points are, so we'll establish some boundaries which we think are on the safe side of those tipping points. And then they did that. They used the best science available, and for the 9 planetary boundaries, said that for 3 of them, we've already exceeded them. This was in 2009. They reviewed it in 2015. It was now 4 boundaries we'd exceeded. And the most recent assessment, 2023, we're now exceeding 6 of these planetary boundaries. Now, I know you had, you mentioned the donut economy.
Yeah.
Donut
Kate
economy.
Kate Raworth.
A very, very interesting idea, because what Kate Raworth did is she took the planetary boundaries, she took an image of the globe represented by a circle, and then she hollowed out the middle. And that's why it's called a donut, because it looks like a certain kind of donut we eat a lot of here in Canada. And in that center, she put initially, as I recall, the social development goals the UN agreed to. And then she said, well, here's the way to conceive of this. Can we meet these goals without exceeding any of the planetary boundaries? In other words, is there a safe space represented by the width of her donut that we could all occupy? And this image has really caught many people's imagination, and they use it now very effectively at quite often at a local level, a city level, and said, okay, what do we have to do in our city to help the world live within the donut?
Some other of your proposals are, actually, we have already talked about this logic of contraction and convergence and on justice and fairness and the transition. But 2 I would like to point out could be perceived as rather controversial. And how would you argue to get a common understanding on those 2? And that is reduction of the physical scale and limits on throughput. How would you convince politicians to say, okay, this looks like a nice and logic future for society?
Well, that's a great question, and I think I would have to answer it in several ways. First of all, I've spoken about these ideas to different levels of government, and what I find is that the most receptive are the local governments. The least receptive are the more senior levels of government. In Canada, we have municipal, provincial, and federal. But Canada is a huge country. It's not immediately obvious to people, if you don't make an effort to think about it, that there are physical limits living in Canada, 40 million people in a landmass bigger than Europe. But at the local level, where the local communities, the municipalities have responsibility for water, for waste, and they know their physical boundaries, their geographic boundaries very clearly, they're much more open to this concern, how are we going to live within the limits? So that's one line of argument. It's less difficult, perhaps, in smaller countries. I grew up in Britain, which, you know, has a sense of itself because it's basically an island. So you can expect to see more attention and more openness to these kinds of ideas there.
I also think you have an important point here. I think wherever you live, whatever country you live in, that you have a better feeling of empowerment when you approach local decision makers. So you can always start there and then go your way up.
That's where you can start. And of course, there's one organization that's global and city focused, and that's the C40 cities, which comes at climate change at the city level. It says, what can we do as a city to reduce emissions? I think they're making a great contribution, and that's all mayors. They're all politicians. The second point I would make is that, in fact, we do impose a lot of limits in our societies. It can be speed limits. It can be limits on what you can consume. It can be drinks and drugs and things of that sort. It can be limits on land use. We have a green belt surrounding Toronto that is quite well known internationally, and our current provincial government decided it was going to allow development of some of the green belt. There was a huge outcry, and the government had to back off. So there's a certain awareness of limits that are used. We're used to fishing limits because it's kind of understood that if you don't limit fishing, especially on the high seas, you get overfishing. That's part of overshoot. So you need to find ways to limit fishing by limiting gear, size of ships, and light fishing licenses. So what we're really saying when we talk about limits is saying, what are the things that really have to be limited to escape from overshoot? We talked about throughput. So what are the places in which we should impose the most critical limits?
A link to that, I think you also reason about this economic theories about when markets is a possible tool and when other tools should be used. Like when you have a rivalry in exploiting a resource and when it's possible to exclude some people or it's wanted to exclude some people from this resource using capital as the requirement and so on. So could you explain a little bit like when could markets work and when you need other tools?
Yes. Well, so you've mentioned two very important concepts that economists use. The rivalry, which means that take bread as an example. If you consume bread, then I can't consume that same bread. In that sense, that the commodity is rival in consumption. If one person consumes it, another can't. And you can contrast that, say, with street lighting, which is non-rival. If I'm walking on the street, enjoying the lighting, you can do the same thing. The lighting I benefit from is no less for you. So that's one very important point. The other one is exclusion. For a market to work, you must be able to exclude people who don't pay for something, because otherwise they would just take it. So you've got to be able to exclude others from consuming something that you think is yours. And in fact, a market can be seen as trading these exclusionary rights from one person to another. So we have possible four categories with rivalry and non-rivalry, exclusion and non-exclusion. Now, when we ask the question of, well, what kind of institutions do we need for these four possible kinds of things that are in our world? We can answer it as follows. For the market to work, as economists like to say that it does work, you need both rivalry and exclusion. So a good example is all the things you see on the shelves in the supermarket. They're rival, one person consumes that much less for somebody else, and there is a great exclusion system in the sense that there's security on the door very often, and there's a whole core system if you steal something, and all of that. So you've got exclusion and rivalry. That's when the market works. But then we've got three other possible combinations. If something is non-rival and non-exclusionary, the market, just you can't have a market. You must have exclusion for a market to work. You must be able to exclude people who haven't paid for it from consuming. So when we used to use air quality as an example, if the air quality is bad in the city, well, everybody is going to benefit from it being cleaned up. You can't exclude people. We don't have an easy exclusionary mechanism.
And actually, there you actually don't want it. You want to clean it up for all of us. So there you wouldn't want to have a market even. It's inefficient.
Well, the market cannot exist. But that doesn't mean that capitalism doesn't look for ways to exclude and to make money. So what kind of institutions do we need for a society that's not living in overshoot? And so now we have four possible types or combination. We can use the market for things that fall naturally into rivalry and exclusion, and we can use perhaps other institutions, political institutions, social institutions, neighborhood arrangements, and equivalent things in the rural areas for the other three. Cooperatives, there's so many different possibilities, but we have to first recognize the nature of the problem, which is we've got a very complicated requirement for system change, and the market is only going to be useful for one part of what's going on within that system. So I'm not opposed totally to the market. Market can be very useful, but it's limited in what it's good for solving problems of.
And then you had the small little thing on capitalism as one of the points.
Capitalism is an evolving system. The capitalism of the 19th century is not the capitalism of today, and capitalism takes on different forms in different countries. It's a changing system. So we have to recognize that, because otherwise, if you think it's fixed and rigid, how do you change it? It's a much harder task. What we've got to do is influence the direction of change. So that's one perspective. The second thing is, one of the reasons why capitalism or any economic system changes is because of the pressures that build up within that system that require change. And we're now in an era where many of these most important pressures are the result of overshoot, of demanding more from nature than nature can provide. So capitalism is going to change if we don't do anything about it. I have no doubt about that. And it may change in a very undesirable fashion, with the increasing inequality, increasing power of small groups of people and businesses, the weakening of government, which is sort of a direction that I think we're going in. Or we need to be more thoughtful about it and talk about the kind of economic and political system we would like to have. That's a conversation that you hear periodically, and then it disappears.
Yeah.
But it needs to come back, I think, and to be informed more than it has been in the past by the predicament we now find ourselves in, with placing such pressure on the planet and not really knowing what to do about it.
So, if everybody in the decision-making power role here on the planet would read your book, and they agree with you on we should avoid overshoot, how urgent is it to take action?
Oh, wow. That's probably the easiest question you asked me. We're way late in taking action. This was seen coming at least 50 years ago when I was an economics student, and shortly after the book The Limits to Growth was published, 1972, which, for all its shortcomings, gave us a view of the 21st century, which is looking unnervingly like what we are now experiencing. Their population projection was pretty accurate. Their assessment that if the trends that were going on then were to continue, and largely they have, we would be looking at system failure in the natural systems, and then in the economic systems, social systems, sometime in the mid-21st century. So that's just to say there have been voices around telling us we better get on with it. And the real problem is, although there have been some moves in the right direction, some of which we've been able to talk about today, they're way too slow. They're too slow, and they're not turning around the trends that need to be reversed. So we're still celebrating the fact that mining is increasing, roads are being built, we're moving into electric vehicles. Whenever I read about this, I'd like to know, when people move to an electric vehicle, what do they do with their old car? There's no guarantee that someone got an electric vehicle means that their other car is no longer being used. And so you see data on percentage of new vehicles that are electric, as if that's all to the good. Anyway, whereas I think more shared transport, public transport of various kinds would be much, much better for the environment. So, and this goes back, if I may just to quickly loop back, to well-being. What well-being requires is mobility. The question is, what are the different ways of providing mobility to people? And the answer to that, I don't think, is billions of electric cars.
And I will go one step further, even saying well-being economy is reducing people's need for mobility by having a healthcare center, a library, a food market closer to home.
Yeah, I absolutely agree. It's mobility for what purpose? Maybe we can satisfy that purpose in a better way. That's great. I agree with that.
Well, on that note, maybe we should end this episode because I think there are so many aspects that you want to change. But if we have a clear mindset on that overshoot is the problem we need to deal with, it means that we understand it's urgent. We need to take action now. We need to change many parts of society, and we need to do it together for the common purpose. So I think that's what I take home from our dialogue today. And I hope that our listeners enjoy you listening to you as much as I have been doing. Thank you so much.
You're very welcome. Thank you for the opportunity.